This is Strange Harbor. Ghosts, UFOs, aliens, Sasquatch, and all things strange.
This pilot, though, who flew Barack Obama during his 2008 presidential campaign, says UFOs are real, and he's seen one firsthand.
An unidentified object seen over the sky above the Rosedale area.
The shot today video that's got all of Texas talking, probably the whole country, from iReporter, who shot this on a cell phone near Stephenville, Texas. The UFO, according to witnesses, and the witnesses include local police and other public figures.
When several dozen residents looked up and saw a UFO more than once.
Three very mysterious shiny lights over Breckenridge have police and residents puzzled.
Tonight we have never before seen videotape of UFOs over Colorado.
If you noticed strange lights in the sky over the weekend, you aren't alone. KCTV5's Alan Shope went to Lee's Summit to get to the bottom of more than a dozen UFO sightings.
Never before seen footage of UFO sightings this year are being shown at a conference in Pontefract.
Local police never definitively said who's to blame. Locals say it has to be something out of this world.
I was taking a random picture, zoomed it in, and there it was. There was a UFO.
Strange Harbor, ghosts, UFOs, aliens, Sasquatch, all things strange.
And another exciting episode of Strange Harbor, where we talk about the weird.
The strange, the unusual, the unnatural, the unruffled, the... Oh my God, there's so many uns out there.
There are a lot of uns out there, and you're one of the best unners I know.
What an honor.
Johnny and Billy here, and we like to talk about weird, strange topics like UFOs, alien abduction, Sasquatch, near death, ghosts, what else?
All kinds of fun things, you know. If it's weird, if it's strange, if it's paranormal, we want to talk about it.
We are a real radio show. We're not hobbyists. You don't see any fancy backdrops or sponsors, probably because we have no listeners, but oh well, we have fun doing it, right?
We got 2 Facebook likes.
Hey, it's a start. All right, generating those likes.
Yeah.
What do you want to talk about today, man?
Hey, I had some experiences a couple years back that I wanted to talk about. I think I may have mentioned them once before, but I want to talk about them again.
Okay.
Because I think that they're relevant. I think that there's a stirring amongst
Uh-oh.
The spirits.
Uh-oh.
And, you know, I feel it. It's you know, it's like a disturbance in the force. And this was probably back in... The first one is back about 2006, I think. And my wife Shannon and I were on a little road trip, and we stopped in Deadwood, North Dakota. Now, Deadwood is like the home of lots of shoot 'em up kind of stuff from the old Wild West.
And sounds like it.
And it's a pretty pretty famous place. I know that several famous people died there.
Mm.
But when we first got there, we could feel the energy of all these ghosts. And we went out to dinner that first night, and we're walking down the street, and it was like I didn't see them, because I'm not one of those people that sees ghosts as much.
Well, you only have one eye.
Well,
it's probably
yeah.
harder to see ghosts.
It is. They always sneak up on my blind side. But I do sense them. I feel them. I, you know, I have a strong awareness of them. Now, my wife is very sensitive to this as well. And she's even more so than I am. I mean, she can talk to them readily and can occasionally see them. But we're walking down the street, and it's suddenly like we were surrounded by these spirits. And these are spirits from the Old West. It was an interesting sensation. It was kind of creepy in a way. It was almost like they were touching us all over, you know, like people grabbing at you.
In a good way or bad way?
Well, not in a very good way, really. But I mean, it was like they were trying to pull us in different directions.
Down into hell.
Down into hell. it was a very interesting thing. That after dinner that night, we went for another little walk, and we walked to the place where I think it was Bill Hickok or one of those, or maybe it was Wyatt Earp or somebody who got killed there, had died. And that the energy, the spirit energy there was incredible. I mean, it was so intense. And in fact, the whole town was. I had wild dreams that night, and we couldn't wait to get out of there the next day, but we had to get it back on the road.
You said you went to eat and you stayed. Is it like a tourist attraction there?
It's a town. It's actually a town where people live, and it's kind of a tourist place, and they have casinos and saloons and gambling, and they have some nice restaurants. And
did you get a chance to talk to any locals?
We did. Actually, we stayed at the Bill Hickok Motel, and we talked to the owner there. I didn't know she was the owner at the time we first started talking to her, but she said that she often feels spirits there. She said she's not, you know, when she first got there, she wasn't a real big believer in all that, but she's come to believe in it over time because of so many incidents. Mm. And she says that there have been times when, you know, she's been sitting in the lobby of the motel there, and something will fall off the wall, or a pen will fly off the desk, or something will turn over. A cup of coffee will spill on the other side of the room. And so, you know, this was interesting. The other thing was that I had been out on book tour. My book hadn't been out for a very long time, so it was still relatively new. And we went to eat breakfast in the little cafe at the Bill Hickok Motel. And we went in and we sat down. It's just a small place, a little diner. The waitress came over and you know, she was really friendly and chatty. And I had a copy of my book sitting on the table. She said, well, you know, what brings you here to Deadwood? And we told her that I'd been out on book tour and all this, and that we were on a road trip and coming back from a speaking engagement. And she said, oh, what's the name of your book? And I showed her the book, and she said, that's the book that our dishwasher read, and he said it changed his whole life.
Wow.
And I said, well, is he here? And she said, no, it's his day off, but let me call him. So she calls him up. We're on the phone with the dishwasher who had read my book. Here we are in Deadwood, North Dakota.
Right.
You know, and here's a guy that read my book, and it had only sold maybe, you know, 1,000 copies at that time. And so it wasn't like it was a big seller or anything. And we run into a guy, and we talked for a little while on the phone. And she had me brought some things over for me to autograph and give to him. But I thought that was interesting, that here we were in this very spirit-filled place. You know, there were lots of lingering spirits and spirit energy there. Me, an obscure author, and a book that had not been on the market very long, and there's a guy that had read it and said it changed his life.
Right.
So I thought that was kind of weird and strange. When we left, though, it was like we got out of there and we went back in. I think we were in, I don't remember what city we were in as we drove out of there, but it was like leaving a part of yourself behind.
Hmm.
That left a little piece of our own spirit there. Anyway, I just thought that was interesting. If you ever have a chance to go to Deadwood, go out and see it, you know, go see what it is.
Is there a lot of dead wood there?
No, not really.
No?
But there are some pretty woods. There's some pretty living woods out there.
Okay.
And it's a nice place. I mean, the people are nice, and it's a fun place if you like to gamble or drink or eat. They have some shows and things that they put on out there. So it's a fun place. It's a good tourist place. If you're if you like, you know, spirits of the Old West,
mm-hmm.
That's a good place to go experience them. We've been there, actually. We've gone back several times, and we've always had interesting experiences. And we always stay at the Bill Hickok Motel. There was one time I didn't think we were going to get out of there because it had snowed overnight. And it snowed quite a bit. So they get some pretty heavy snowfalls there. Hmm. Ground was kind of frozen, and Bill Hickok Motel sits kind of down in a little dip. So it was quite a challenge to get out of the parking lot.
Do you think that the ghosts were attracted to you because you've been where they are?
I think that Shannon and I are probably more sensitive to those feelings because we've experienced them many, many times. We have a better connection to that kind of energy. I do believe that they are attracted to us as well, simply because we're able to recognize them more. I mean, the average person who has no interest in that may walk down the streets and, you know, feel something a little strange, but they may not think of it as ghosts or spirits or anything other than, you know, their own feelings. And so not everybody can do it. Not everybody feels it. Not everybody senses it. But I think if you become aware of the energy of the universe and the energy of the spirit, then you are more likely to feel it or sense it when you get near it. I mean, it's always there. It's always with us. It's just that when you encounter other spirits, there's an intensity in that. On a subsequent trip, not on that trip, but on a subsequent trip where we were on a road trip, we were in Montana, Deer Lodge, Montana, and we stopped at the Deer Lodge State Prison. It's a Montana state prison. Now, it hasn't been a functional prison in a long time. It's an abandoned place. But I'll tell you that we walked out into the courtyard of that prison. The spirit energy was overwhelming, absolutely overwhelming. Now, it was a cold day. It gets pretty chilly in Montana. And it was a cold day, but it wasn't that bone-chilling cold. You know, a nice jacket would handle things. When we went out in that courtyard, the cold became unbearable. Hmm. It was so cold. It felt like it had dropped, you know, 20 or 30 degrees. Shannon actually had to leave because she said that, you know, the spirits were saying things to her and were taunting her and such. And I didn't have quite that experience, but I certainly could feel the spirit energy in every part of the place where we went. And finally, we had to leave just because it was too cold and there was too many spirits there.
So what kind of things were they doing or saying?
They were telling her to come over to the other side. And for me, I mean, I walked into one of the offices where, I think it was a nursing office or something that was there in the prison. And I couldn't actually see forms, but I could sense those forms in that office, the people that were there tending to the prisoners. It was quite interesting, just that the sense of all the spirituality. So it's another good place to visit, you know, if you're into spirits and ghosts and things. I would suggest you go in the summertime when it's warmer.
Mm-hmm.
And also be aware that there's, I think it's a $7 or $10 fee or something to get in. You have to go through the gift shop and then you buy a ticket and you can go in. But it's worth the price of admission. It's an incredible place.
So if ghosts are real, reincarnation is real, how does that work? I mean, do you get a choice like, okay, well, you can either be reincarnated and go back and live again, or you can stay on this side and grab tourists when they're when they're walking around, or when they're in vacant prisons, and tell them to come
over? Well, you know, we think about the spirit as being a single entity. And yet, I think that the spirits that we encounter, like in Deadwood or in at this prison or other places like that, haunted houses, are not whole entities. They are pieces of that entity. They're energy that's left behind by the spirit of that person. We have the ability to leave behind signature energy, unique energy. It would be like a unique radio frequency. And we can leave a little bit of that behind, and people encounter that. Of course, the more that's left behind, the more strong the encounter. And it's so, especially if there's a lot of people leaving this behind over a period of time. My theory, is that spirits, like human beings, are born, they live, they grow, they learn, and eventually they evolve and probably die, or at least are converted to some other form of energy. I'm not sure. I'm not sure what happens at the end point, whether that energy is absorbed by another being. You know, it's my sense that they become, in a way of saying this, that's more relative to people's belief systems, is they become absorbed by God. They become a part of God. Now, I don't know if that makes sense to anybody, but but you have to realize that this spirit, from birth to being absorbed by God, is in our time probably billions of years. So when that spirit comes here, depending on how old it is, have you ever heard people say, well, that person is an old spirit? So as the spirit gets more experience and knowledge, it grows. It becomes wiser, it becomes stronger. And, you know, my belief is that these spirit energies inhabit all living things. But when a spirit inhabits, say, a plant or a tree or even an animal, that those are younger spirits, much younger spirits. But they're gaining information and knowledge and experience by being a part of that living thing. And then, as they grow older, they come back. And they may come back to this planet, or they may go to some other living planet, some other source of life, where they can gain this experience and knowledge. So, by the time a spirit enters a human being, you know, it's probably had two or three or four other iterations of life. And that means that it's, you know, it's going to learn from us, it's going to grow, and it may even come back at some point. You know, we talk about reincarnation, about the spirit being reborn. And just from my own experiences of having an option to come back, when I had my first near-death experience, I had no option, but I was a much younger spirit. I grew and I learned very fast. I matured as a spirit, probably faster than most. I don't know why. Why was I chosen to get this touch, this information from the other side? I don't know. I can't answer that question. But I do know that I have gotten that information, that I have been selected to do this. Now, maybe everybody can do it. I don't know. But the other thing that I know from that experience is that in later life, when I had near-death experiences out of body, I had a choice to come back or not. And the choice was mine, versus the earlier experiences where I had no choice. The choice was the higher power. In my later life experiences, the choice was all mine. And choosing to come back was not always an easy thing, because it's so wonderful over there. I mean, it's just, there's no politics, no religion, no, I wouldn't say there's no negativity. There are some negative spirits and there are some negative entities there, but for the most part, it's a kind and loving and caring environment. So, if we make the choice to stay here and be reincarnated, it's probably because we have more to learn, Or, I think, in my case, I came back because I have more to give. I have more to teach, and probably more to learn, too. I don't think we ever learned at all. But it's about giving and sharing and loving people and caring for people and helping people to have a better quality of life. And I don't mean to become rich and famous quality of life. I'm talking about a better relationship with themselves so that they can be honest and treat themselves with honesty and caring and knowledge and a sense of fulfillment, a sense of comfort in life. And I think that that was what I came back to help people do. Obviously, I can't help everybody, but...
How selfish are you?
If I can help, if I can help one or two people, those people then can go on and help others. Why? This is long. So I can write a whole book on this. So, talking about this in a short time is hard because I have to kind of pick what I'm going to say here and not get too deep into explanations. But as spirit beings, as human beings with a spirit, we're entering an age of enlightenment. It may not seem like it. It may seem like we're going backwards sometimes, but in reality, we are entering an age of enlightenment, an age when we will have a better knowledge of the universe, a better knowledge of the energy of the universe, how it can work for us or against us, and what we can do to make that energy a part of our everyday life. So, this enlightenment, while I would love it to happen tomorrow, is probably still, you know, 40, 50, 60 years in the future. But we're moving towards it. We are pioneering it right now. We are making the change. And for human beings, the changes seem to take forever, but you know, if you're a spirit that lives a billion years, you know, the time we spend on this planet with this human form is just a matter of moments, actually. It's a very short time.
That's a bunch of New Age tooey.
There you go.
Well, it's Strange Harbor where we talk about the weird, and coming up, the Earth is flat. No, wait, the Earth is round. Why have the flat out wrong?
What flat? Flat earthers?
Wait. You interjected too soon on that.
I'm sorry.
Why have the flat earthers been around so long when we've proven the earth isn't flat? Does that make sense? We're going to talk about flat earth coming up.
All right. We'll do that.
You're listening to Strange Harbor. Ghosts, UFOs, aliens, Sasquatch, all things strange. Online at strangeharbor.net. Strange Harbor. Be strange.
Welcome to Strange Harbor. If you've had an out-of-the-ordinary experience, then come to strangeharbor.net and let us know what it is.
It's Strange Harbor, where we talk about the weird and, as promised, flat earth. You're familiar with the flat earth theory, right, Billy?
I am familiar with it, yes.
People think the earth is flat.
They think it's flat. They think that there is an ice barrier around the edge, and that's what holds everything in. And there's a variety of different theories about why we have a sky and,
right,
you know, and what happens when we shoot things into outer space.
Well, here's a presentation on this whole flat Earth thing.
Back in about 200 BC, a Greek named Eratosthenes realized the sun was directly overhead in southern Egypt during the summer solstice. He knew this because the sun could be seen reflected off the water at the bottom of deep wells. But in Alexandria in northern Egypt, this wasn't the case. Eratosthenes realized he could calculate the angle of the sun by measuring the length of a stick and the shadow it cast. With that angle, knowing the distance between the two locations in Egypt, he could calculate the circumference of the Earth. And he did this with a surprising degree of accuracy, considering that a lot of the measurements he used to do so were pretty crude. There's something notable about all of this. The Earth can only have a circumference if it's actually round. We knew that the Earth was round over 2,000 years ago. How can it be possible people are still arguing about this? To some extent, in our everyday experience, the Earth sure does look flat, but this belief can only exist if people ignore the centuries of evidence that have accumulated since the time of Eratosthenes. For example, people sailed around the globe in 1522 and have been filling in the details ever since. We even developed the ideas of latitude and longitude in order to track our progress across the sphere of the Earth. We've been looking at other planets and stars since Galileo developed the telescope in 1609, and all of those are spheres. We now know how planets form and how gravity will shape anything with as much mass as the Earth into a sphere over time. We've now gone high enough into the atmosphere that we could see the curvature of the Earth ourselves. We've even done so from the vicinity of the Moon. Multiple countries now have space programs based on the idea that you could put stuff into orbit around the Earth. But you don't need to be NASA to see this. All you really need is a big balloon and a good enough camera. That's put it within the reach of high schools and universities. But despite the ever-growing evidence, flat Earth believers have been with us the whole time. Back in the 1800s, one flat Earth proponent even took a bet with Alfred Russel Wallace. He's the guy who independently came up with the theory of evolution. Wallace used to be a surveyor and knew how to test whether the Earth was round. To do so, he used a 6-mile stretch of straight canal. He put two poles, one at either end of that stretch, and a third one in the middle. The third one clearly stood out above the other two, indicating that it was raised to a higher level by the bulge of the Earth. The person who made the bet refused to accept the results. Years of lawsuits and even death threats for Wallace followed. This may have proven a lesson for modern bookies. When a UK citizen called around to betting shops to find somebody who would give him the odds on the Earth being flat, he didn't find any takers. In the intervening years, flat Earth advocates have come up with elaborate geometries that supposedly make the whole thing work. To do so, they have to shrink the entire solar system. The sun has to be very small, very close, and follow a meandering path in order to supposedly set across a flat Earth. The polar regions are supposedly much larger and create an ice wall that sets the boundaries on the flat Earth. And they reject the entire idea of gravity. To them, satellites are all fake. None of this makes any sense, but it's what you have to believe if you think the Earth is flat. Their refusal to accept evidence hasn't changed since Wallace's time. A few years back, the Discovery Channel had a program where they used lasers and telescopes to show that the surface of a large lake was curved due to the curvature of the Earth.
Let me know when you can see us on spots of the horizon. All right, Brian, how many feet are we above the lake?
24 feet.
The flat Earth proponents responded to this program with a series of videos on YouTube.
I'm going to go with CGI on that whole helicopter thing because people would say, oh, look, well, what do you mean it's CGI? You saw the helicopter? Yeah, I also seen giant robots fighting in downtown Chicago. That doesn't make it real.
All of which supposedly show errors made by the people behind the Discovery Channel program. What drives this sort of stubborn refusal to deal with reality? Part of the problem is that even the simplest demonstrations, like Wallace's or the Discovery Channel's, require careful preparation and specialized equipment. Not everybody has access to a helicopter and a telescope to do these sorts of tests. That's often a complaint that the flat Earth people make. They need to personally experience the evidence, rather than trusting the measurements of other people. That's in part because the people who do these measurements are often experts, and society's trust in experts in general has gone down. Things may be worse in this case because people who believe in conspiracy theories tend to have lower trust in others overall. The people who feel that way have to believe that NASA, universities, the people who run the GPS system, and more are all hiding something from them. The explanation can't just be that these people are wrong. NASA had to have actually faked all those pictures of a round Earth for a flat Earth to be true. Studies have shown that people who believe in conspiracy theories tend to like to feel unique. And what could be more unique than believing in something that seems so outlandish? Conspiracy theorists also have a tendency to believe in nonsense that sounds profound. The technical term for this, and I'm not making this up, is called bullshit receptivity. This may explain why they enjoy believing all the baroque reasons people have come up with for why a flat Earth can still have seasons. These factors may not explain why any one individual doesn't believe that the Earth is round, but they go a long way towards explaining why 2,200 years later, flat Earth believers are still with us.
I resent that he lumped conspiracy theorists in there with flat earthers.
I think he was right on, but...
Right, he was. And one of the reasons, according to a new study, YouTube is at least partly responsible for the rise in flat earthers, citing the plethora of misinformation on the video sharing platform as one of the biggest reasons why people are rejecting scientific fact in favor of the flat earth theory. What do you think of that? YouTube. It's YouTube. YouTube's fault.
Well, I believe it because there's so much propaganda on YouTube.
Right.
I would say that probably 60% or more of what you see on YouTube is not real. Mm-hmm. Is someone's opinion or someone's creation, or it's just deliberate propaganda.
Right.
Deliberately intended to mislead people. Because we live in an age when we are, for lack of a better term, easily led by the nose. You know, if somebody dangles a little something that sounds halfway credible in front of us, you know, we run after it. And we think, oh, well, it's on YouTube or it's on television or on the radio.
Right.
That somehow it's real. Somehow there must be some reality to it, because how could they get on this media and just tell bald-faced lies?
They say there's a lot of helpful information on YouTube, but also a lot of misinformation.
Yeah.
Their algorithms make it easy to end up going down the rabbit hole by presenting information to people who are going to be more susceptible to it. So.
Well, yeah, it's easy. And, you know, I did a few years back, local prison out here asked me to come out and speak to the prisoners. And we couldn't quite find a time when I could get out there. So I told them, I'll just do a video, mm-hmm. and I'll post it on YouTube. And then you can watch it anytime you want. Thinking, you know, this is kind of a private thing. And,
right.
you know, nobody's going to see it other than me and those prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
Well, somebody got a hold of the video, posted it on their website, and it now has like 74,000 views. That means 74,000 people, or maybe less, because some have probably
they
watched
saw
it
your
twice.
propaganda.
But had I just told something that was a bald-faced lie,
mm-hmm.
they would believe it. Fortunately, the things that I said I truly believe in, and I don't think that they were lies. Because they were personal experiences. It's so easy. I mean, if you've got a computer and a webcam, I mean, you can just plug right in and you can say and do anything you want.
Mm-hmm.
There are people that get on every morning and just talk BS. If you give an opinion, it's my opinion that cars would run better with square wheels. Okay, I can just say that, and people will say, yeah, cars should have square wheels instead of round. I'll bet you that I could get 10% of the people that listen to me to believe that cars should have square wheels, and I'll bet you I could get 10% of those to come to my place and buy some square wheels.
Wait a minute.
For their car.
Time out. Are you behind this whole flat earth thing?
I am.
Did you say to yourself, you know, I think I can get... So many people thinking that the earth is flat. You're behind it, aren't you? I knew it.
I am. I'm the guy. I'm perpetrating this lie. I'm not. I don't. I'm not a flat earth believer. I'm not a conspiracy theory believer. You know, I believe that there's a truth to everything. And the truth to flat earth is that people aren't willing to look at the facts. That's the truth behind flat earth. But
how about NASA's telescope spotting a cosmic cannonball hurling through space at 694 miles per second?
We have a lot of those. They're called meteors and asteroids and those kind of things. So the question is, what is it?
Right. Where did it come from?
And where did it come from? But it could have come from, there's lots of things hurtling through space.
Mm-hmm.
And there's lots of round things.
A lot of our junk.
Most, yeah. We got a lot of space junk up there.
Right.
I saw. It was like an overlaid photo kind of thing,
mm-hmm,
that showed every satellite and every piece of junk that's in space, and there's like this massive ring around the Earth of all this junk that's up there.
Right. We trashed the Earth, now yeah, we're trash in space.
We tend to be trashy people.
Now, according to the people that are looking into this, number J0002, it's like the Sonic the Hedgehog version of a pulsar, faster than 99% of those we've measured in the past. Now, could something like this hitting the Earth do something bad to us, like Armageddon?
Yeah, anything that hits the Earth can do something bad because it's going to disrupt our environment. It's going to disrupt the balance of the Earth. It's going to disrupt our weather patterns. It's going to disrupt our energy fields. So, yeah, anything that hits the Earth, be it solid or in some kind of wave form, is going to do some damage. The question is it damage we can recover from?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it, you know, a global extinction event? You know, if a big asteroid or a meteor hit the Earth, I mean, it could essentially destroy everything on the planet because it would put us into basically the same thing as nuclear winter, or it would create massive tidal waves, earthquakes. It could create smoke or steam clouds that would block the sun's rays, and we would all freeze to death, or we would starve to death because we couldn't grow food. There's a lot of things that happen. Our planet is really very fragile, you know, and we're doing a tremendous amount of damage to it every day, and more so than it can recover from.
So maybe one of these would be a good thing.
A global extinction event?
Right.
Well, yeah, start over, you know. It's thought that, and I don't have a lot of evidence about what happened, you know, billions of years ago and with dinosaurs and all that. But it's thought that possibly that kind of event happened that caused all the dinosaurs to be extinct. But, of course, it wouldn't have destroyed their DNA, which would still be in the Earth, and therefore there could still be some kind of evolution after that.
There could be a reason why we haven't had the global extinction due to a big asteroid or comet or something else. Some are speculating that the Earth is a galactic zoo and we're being protected by aliens, and scientists are meeting to investigate the great silence. It's the Fermi paradox. Like, well, if there's over 50 billion exoplanets out there, the probability of other life, intelligent life being out there, where is everybody? How come nobody's made contact? Well, some say, well, they have made contact, and some say they've made deals with our government. Conspiracy theory, right?
Yeah.
You know, in exchange for being able to abduct us, the government's getting access to different technology, because you notice the difference in technologies from the Roswell and the Maury Island incident. After those things happened, all of a sudden, you know, we get this big kind of spike in technology. Is that just a coincidence?
No. I think that we do. I think we get information from maybe extraterrestrial sources. To me, who is a, you know, I'm the biggest skeptic of all on when it comes to some of this stuff. But I do believe that we have had communication with beings outside of our planet. And I think that we have had communication or maybe even intervention and not even been aware of it. Because in addition to extraterrestrial travel, which I believe is not by spaceship, because that would require the set of physics that probably doesn't exist. But a set of physical parameters that probably doesn't exist, although it may. What if people are coming here interdimensionally? During one of my out-of-body experiences, I was able to travel the universe and see things throughout the universe. I was able to go from billions of miles with just a thought. And so if other civilizations have reached that level of enlightenment, they could travel here without a spaceship or without a spacesuit or anything else, but they certainly wouldn't exist in human form. They would exist in a energy form.
Now, according to that Russian boy who was recalling a past life, and he's recalling details as a child about things that he shouldn't know about, right?
Right.
One of the things he talked about was teleportation. He said he lived a past life on Mars, and people from Mars traveled in many galaxies and planetary systems. There were ships of an airplane type. They were triangular. They were ships like a drop. He said these ships used plasma power, ion power. If they used gasoline, they ran out too fast. The engines were too powerful. He talked about teleportation, saying that portal is the same like teleport. It slows down time and opens a kind of a portal where time is speeding up fast. He says, I can't exactly say. I don't remember. It opens on one side, and in a few seconds or even minutes, if the transfer is far away, it opens another area of space. He went on to say, not all ships had the same principle. Ships with plasma engines were limited to travel only in the solar system on high speed. The ships in the shape of a drop were carrying other ships. Each race had its own technology and innovations. For example, if we had plasma and ion engines, others had energy engines. He spoke about other people from other planets, planetary cooperation, and wars. He spoke on people that still live on Mars, but who live beneath the surface and inside of the planet. According to him, they breathe CO2. And this interview is very detailed. It's by this Project Camelot, where they interview past lives. 100% of them have been kids that recall these details of past lives. But
right.
I thought this was interesting because he talks about portals.
Right. Kids are more open-minded because they haven't been tainted by society. they haven't been brainwashed or
right.
You know, convinced to believe something else. Also, just as we grow older, some of those abilities to think beyond our own plane of existence, they go away. As we get older in life, we have less ability to open our mind to these great things and to communicate outside of our own being. We become more isolated within ourselves and more selfish sometimes. But
you know, it wasn't long ago NASA called for a press conference to announce that there seems to be water, rivers of flowing water on Mars, what we once believed to be an arid and rocky desert of a planet that's actually seasonal, not like our own planet Earth. But you don't hear much about it. I mean, they made the announcement, but before it was like, Mars, the desert planet, the desert red planet of Mars. And, oh, we found rivers of water. Okay, whatever. Oh, it has seasons too. Okay, whatever. Hey, the desert planet of Mars.
Well, yeah, because if you look at Mars right now, even with our Mars rover, I mean, it was pretty desolate. You know, it was sandy, rocky terrain. What if we could look back 100 million years? We are so set in our little lifetime. You know, we have existed for only a matter of minutes. Human beings have existed just a matter of minutes in the entire scope of the universe. So what we see in that matter of minutes is not what things were or what things will be.
Mm-hmm.
There will be a time, most likely, that planet Earth will probably look a lot like Mars does now.
Mm-hmm.
And we as human beings will no longer be able to live here because it will not sustain our life. It was interesting about the little kid talking about people breathing CO2. human beings can't breathe CO2. We are, it will kill us.
Mm-hmm.
But we are creating more and more CO2 in our atmosphere, because that's what global warming and climate change is all about. The fact that we are producing more CO2 than our planet can convert to oxygen.
Maybe we're prepping it for the Martians to come here and take over.
It's possible. Or maybe we're just killing it so that we have to go somewhere else.
Go to an already dead planet.
But remember, when we, if we are just a vehicle for a spirit that's here to learn, once this body dies and this planet dies, those spirits still exist. And they can travel the universe, and they can go to other planets and intervene with other living beings. So, in essence, there's a part of us that lives on forever, or at least what appears to be forever in our vision. And then there's a part of us that dies, because we don't take with us everything that we are. We only take with us the essence of what we are. And I know that's not clear, but...
It's New Age hooey.
It's New Age hooey, yeah. But it's, you know, we have to start thinking in terms of our spiritual beings. We have to start thinking in terms of being enlightened. We have to start thinking not just personally, but we have to start thinking globally and universally.
That's not going to happen when there's a sale at Ross. Sorry.
They'll all be knocking each other over to get to that pair of shoes, right?
Right, yeah. Right. Totally.
Yeah, okay. Well, you know, we have to grow up eventually. And right now, you know, you said that what if the planet is just a galactic zoo or something? If it is, I think Washington, D.C. is the monkey cage.
Well, that'll do it for this episode of Strange Harbor. If you would like to contact us, yell at Billy for his New Age hooey. If you want to be a guest, if you have had an experience you'd like to share, all that, log on to strangeharbor.net.
Stay strange.
Nicely done.
You're listening to Strange Harbor. Ghosts, UFOs, aliens, Sasquatch, all things strange. Online at strangeharbor.net. Strange Harbor. Be strange.